This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antic. Charlie Sutherland is a Scottish architect and founder of Sutherland Hussey Harris. He is the speaker tonight at the Pertubuhan Architect Malaysia's Design Lecture Series happening at the Black Box in Publica, 7:45 p.m. Charlie, thank you for being here.
Pleasure. Welcome.
Perhaps we can start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, yes, I born in Scotland and educated at the McIntosh School of Architecture. I subsequently went to work in London for Sir James Stirling, who's an international architect, and kind of learnt my trade. And then moved back to Scotland to set up my practice in about 25 years ago now. So, and have been working both in Scotland and overseas internationally.
Is that a typical rite of passage for a young British architect to move to London to hone their craft and learn a trade?
Certainly at the time I graduated, it was definitely really the only opportunities available to us at that time. The economy wasn't very good in Scotland, and London has always been a huge magnet for young people, and still is. Most of us, I'm a professor at Glasgow School of Art, and most of our students tend to gravitate towards London still to learn the business of architecture and the art of architecture.
So job opportunities today, are they still clustered around major city centres?
Very much so in terms of architecture. I mean, there's it's where the money is, where the investment is, and it's where the innovation happens. So obviously London is one of the great financial centres in Europe.
Speaking of innovation, your presentation this evening is titled Between Infinite and Definite. Can you give us a brief teaser of what you'll be speaking on?
Well, it's really about the way that architects sort of live in the world between the real and the imagined. And, of course, we have to imagine projects before they become real. So we live in this kind of quasi-world of what is tangible, intangible. I suppose what is the science of architecture and what is the art of architecture? And I'm really illustrating through a few projects that we have developed over the last 25 years our take on that, really, and how we interpret that.
Right. Can you give an example of this difference between the arts and science? When you speak to a client, usually do they give you the science or do they give you more of the arts?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, many clients are very different in the way they see a project. In many cases, we're given a very kind of pragmatic program of spaces and what they want to fit in and their aspirations for the building. And in many cases, it's very difficult for them to make that step into how to make that tangible. And I think that's our role as architects, is to kind of develop that kind of intuition, that kind of the unknowable, and bring that to the fore and release that from a project. So we bring an added value, I think.
Do you like it when clients... is there certain clients who would prefer to be surprised by the final product, or usually they are rigid about what they want and they have a vision? As an architect, do you prefer to have more leeway in not having the client set a fixed vision so you have more flexibility to work around?
I think our experience over the lifetime of our practice is that we've generally had a very good fit with the clients that we have. So maybe there's a kind of symbiotic relationship that we've developed in the way that we work. We are given a certain amount of freedom, I guess, to interpret the brief and to develop this intangible aspect of the infinite. And I think that's... But many clients come in many different guises, and some clients are very definite about what they want. So it's a balance, really. And hopefully... in developing a relationship with clients, which is very much part of the process, it's about trust and acknowledging the skills that we have to bring the intangible to reality.
When did you start getting... I suspect you'll be giving a lot of examples during tonight's presentation. When did you start getting noticed and when clients from abroad started seeking for your expertise? Was there a particular breakthrough moment?
I think it was actually one of our very earliest projects, which I'll show tonight, which was a project developed as a result of Arts Council funding. So it wasn't really a building, it was more of an artwork, a collaboration with four artists in Scotland. And this project, very small, it was only £100,000 to build it, was in a very unique location, and it went on to be shortlisted for the Stirling Prize, the Mies van der Rohe Prize, and got international recognition through the RIBA. And I think that really launched us into a kind of level of international recognition from a very small, tiny project. But I think that project in particular exemplified, I think, some of the ideas of the intangible.
Okay, and because I was struck, but you work on a lot of projects for a relatively small practice. Would that be accurate?
That's right.
And you were invited by the mayor of Chengdu to develop the expansion of the city. Can you tell me more about that project?
Well, that was a few years ago now, and it was at a time when, the whole growth of Chinese cities, as you know, are exponential. So the eastern part of Chengdu was planned to be expanded to develop the idea of creative industries. And I think that's a theme that's been developed here in KL as well. It's the idea that you can have a kind of growth generated through industries, clean industries, intelligent industries. So we were drafted in with our partners in Beijing to develop an idea of how the city might expand to accommodate these industries, as well as developing a kind of understanding of how the networks and the growth of that part of the city could be sustainable. Many of the buzzwords that we use today. But it was a very interesting exercise for us because I think we brought some of the kind of understanding that we have in the European city, particularly the city I come from, Edinburgh, which has a new town that was actually built 250 years ago. And
why was that, though? What was the starting point of the 250 years?
Well, that was a time when Edinburgh was expanding. It had expanding middle class. It had a very medieval core. The city was suffering from serious pollution, hygiene problems. And they were very visionary in the 18th century to develop this idea of the new town, which was all about light, air, embracing the green kind of landscape within the city, but also developing the idea that it was a sustainable city, even then. And it is, I think, probably one of the most sustainable kind of ideas that's been realised 250 years ago.
So how do you seek to translate that sort of landscape into this city like Chengdu?
Well, it's interesting that the east part of Chengdu is actually quite topographic. So there's landscape that's undulating, which is very similar to Edinburgh. It's a city of landscape. As in the centre, it has an old volcanic mountain. So part of the way Edinburgh developed was about allowing the landscape to flow through the city whilst maintaining a kind of openness to the way that the city could expand. So we brought those sort of ideas to the table in terms of developing this eastern new town expansion, embracing the landscape and developing the idea of, in a climatic way, that sort of idea in the east new town of Chengdu.
You know, I was reading at one point a new skyscraper was going up in China every 5 days. And I think you alluded to it, ghost cities is a very real problem over there. Yeah. What are your thoughts about this? Is this a sustainable or healthy way of going about development?
Well, it's a very big question today, and it's something that which, I mean, a lot of the kind of pressures that make these things happen. An architect gets involved at a very late stage in this process, and apart from our involvement with Newtown, you know, a lot of these things are generated by kind of the futures, I guess, of the market, and things change. So I think that's part of the problem is speculation, and the ghost cities are also a symptom of that.
But aren't the Chinese government trying to hijack that process? Because in the past, people would congregate around urban centres because that's where the economy is. Mm. And then they have to find solutions to make everything, you know, work together, yes. Sustainable, make sure resources are allocated efficiently. But now, aren't they building it first? So they bring in the architects first, the urban planners first, and then they get people to move in.
Yeah.
Yeah, but would that be? So I guess would that be an exciting, I guess, canvas to play with as an architect? You get to design from the bottom up, from scratch, literally.
Yeah, I mean, there's never entirely a blank canvas. The kind of context is very, very important. We always develop projects which have a strong understanding of context. In many cases in China, this is forgotten, I think. But yes, to be involved at the very early stages of the planned growth of a city is a fantastic opportunity to bring a lot of these enduring values to bear on how the city might grow. So it's about predicting how people will live in the future and how we can manage resources and all of these things, which become very important because you're planning for 100, 200 or 250 years into the future and hoping that you're going to build a city which has not only a functionality but a beauty, some kind of intangible quality.
My guest today is Charlie Sutherland. He is an architect and a speaker tonight at the Pertubuhan Architect Malaysia's Design Lecture Series happening at the Black Box in Publica at 7:45 PM. Up next, after this short break, I'll ask him about Brexit and something that's on a lot of Scottish people's mind at the moment, you know, the potential referendum. That's up next after this brief break. You're listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Intik. My guest today is Charlie Sutherland, an architect, and tonight's speaker at the Pertubuhan Architect Malaysia's Design Lecture Series at the Black Box in Publica. So, Charlie, I guess this is something that I don't know whether it's related to architect or not, but does Brexit affect your work in any way?
It's very related to architecture. But,
architecture, yes.
Yes, it's. I mean, I can't say that it's actually directly affected us in the short term, but we have a deep concern about what will happen in terms of our relationship with Europe. We have a lot of relationships with practices and with work in the European context. As well as in education, and I'm involved in the Glasgow School of Art, our relationship with Europe are fundamental to the future success of certainly architectural education. So yes, I think we are concerned, but I can't say that it's actually directly affected us to date.
What is the mood of the Scottish people today, if I may put you on the spot?
Well, it's a very...
Excitement? Is it...
I wouldn't say excitement. I think apprehension is really central to the feeling in Scotland. I mean, we've been through, as you know, already one referendum, which was really in the context of our relationship with the UK. And I can say personally that my response in that at that time was really about my concern about our relationship to Europe through our relationship in the UK. So, and I certainly get a feeling that that changed relationship to Europe is certainly making people think again about relationship with the UK. Mm-hmm. or within the UK.
So coming back to architecture, is there such a thing as Scottish architecture?
Well, I mean, historically, yes. I mean, have you visited Scotland?
No, I've not had the good fortune.
I mean, there's a whole series of periods in Scotland which have been represented through Romanticism in the built form. I mean, everyone's vision of Scotland are the wonderful kind of baronial houses and the castles. So there's a sort of, it's definitely an identity that evolved at through Sir Walter Scott and the kind of invention of Scotland as a sort of romantic land. I'm not sure that we live in that world anymore. We live in a more real world. And I certainly think the architecture is driven in a large part by economics and many other factors. But I think you could probably identify, just in the way that buildings have to relate to context, to the landscape. They have a particular way of relating to the landscape in Scotland, so that certainly gives it identity. And the way that we have to deal with climate, so that's another issue that forces the architecture to respond in a very particular way. So if you look at a house in the south of England and a house in Scotland, they're very different kind of animals.
Right. Different degrees of coldness?
Well, climate is a major part. I mean, traditionally we built in stone in Scotland, and it's a very enduring material to do with the weather and to do with the climate. That kind of idea of the mass of a building, the kind of weight of a building, is really important in Scotland. Having said that, we actually now develop much more timber technology, so we're actually responding to the kind of the needs of how we build today, but we also develop very highly insulated buildings. So we have a much more developed culture of that in Scotland than, let's say, in England. In England, they have less pressure on the climate issues.
So if climate has always been the underlying context that architects have to be mindful of, with climate change, when everything is now more erratic and volatile, how do you plan for something like that? How do you future-proof, I guess, a building or a structure?
Well, I think underwriting everything in terms of the way we think has to be about trying to not just plan for the future in terms of how to deal with climate change, but really plan for trying to reduce it in terms of its impact. And so, I mean, the kind of agenda has shifted wholeheartedly towards reduced energy and sustainable resources and all of those issues that the building industry are very much front and centre of how we can address some of these issues for the future. But in terms of future-proofing, in terms of what the effects of climate change are, that's something that is very unpredictable. And we really can't even anticipate some of the... We may have quite wildly different effects that might happen in Scotland. We could become warmer, we could become wetter, we could become colder. We don't really know. We've noticed the fluctuation over the last, certainly since I moved back to Scotland, the dynamic of the weather has changed so radically. We don't get the winters that we used to have, which were very much part of my childhood. We don't have so much snow. So, in a way, we can't predict.
Right. You teach across the US, Europe, and Asia. And I was wondering, for when you teach students who come from different climate background, are they informed by where they come from? Do you notice that students come with pre-existing notions that are different from yours, having been trained in Glasgow?
It's definitely a cultural kind of baggage, if you call it. I don't know if it's in some cases, because at the Glasgow School of Art, we teach in the context of Glasgow, so we kind of try to teach by example, I guess, in terms of using the city as a way of testing ideas. So, in a sense, the context of where the student has come from is kind of left behind when we look at Glasgow, because we have to deal with the particularities of that place. But there's certain cultural interests that will inevitably come through, and so that adds, I think, it's in a way the same way that we work in China. I think that sort of reciprocation of ideas is very fertile and generates a much more dynamic culture.
And so when you teach, do you still today in the I guess the curriculum of architecture, is it still instructed in that way, that you use your the environment around you as an example, or is it much more global now?
Well, I mean, having said that we use Glasgow as a test bed, we also go to the European city, so we look at a kind of diversity of having learned, I guess, a way of looking in Glasgow. We then transport that kind of understanding of how you look at issues and kind of apply that to a context out with. So it's testing the skills testing those skills by changing the circumstance. And I think that's a very important skill that an architect has to develop in these modern times of globalization and the circumstances we find ourselves in China. You have to bring with you those tools, those skills, to be able to apply them in other contexts, and be able to also pick up on all of the kind of resonances of the place that you're working in. So I think that's what we're teaching, is that kind of readability, transportable kind of skills.
Right. What do you teach? Like, what are some of the courses that you are personally responsible for?
Well, it's not a formal sort of lecture program. It's much more about design. So I generally teach in the what we call the thesis year, the final year, and it's very much about the individual student's project. So it's about their idea and helping them develop that idea. So I wouldn't say I'm a teacher so much as I'm a practitioner who enables and helps people into the transition from teaching into the real world. I think that's probably what we bring to the table in terms of our involvement with teaching.
Right. You used the word intangible a lot earlier. Can that be taught?
I think it's awareness of the power and possibilities that's always latent in everything, in every circumstance. And I think it's to do with the ability to read situations. It's a bit like an artist and how an artist might react to situations and respond. I think we try to unlock that kind of sensibility in the way that a student might approach a project. So, yes, I think it could be taught in the sense of how you approach circumstances and respond to them.
How do you organize your practice, because you have projects all over the world? The architects organized into sub-specialty? Like, you work in China, you work in Europe?
Not at all, no. I mean, we're a studio. Fundamentally, the idea that we all work together collaboratively. We generally are involved in what we call the front end of a lot of projects. So it's about the kind of the design idea, the response. But sort of harking back to the time I worked in London for James Stirling, that was very much his practice. He worked from a small office in London, 20 architects, but he worked all over the world. And the way he operated was he had a very strong kind of ethos. The way he represented the work was very clear, and that was transported to executive architects in other parts of the world. So that relationship of working with other architects in other places and having a reciprocal relationship was something that we developed in our practice too. So that's pretty much how we operate. We have a very small studio, and we have partners in other parts of wherever we're working.
Yeah. small studios, a lot of projects, something has to give, right? Long hours, a lot of sleep. That's anecdotally, a lot of my architect friends with students pursuing architecture, they would have a lot of stories of when crunch time comes, a lot of sleepless nights.
I mean, I'd like to think that we're not one of those practices that burn the midnight oil incessantly, and I think we, you know, very much believe that your most creative moments, your most productive time is when you're well-rested and have had a good sleep. So I'm not sure there's a benefit of really forcing that kind of ethos. We really try not to to work like that. I think the way we work, I think, is fairly efficient. we also, as I say, we're developing the kind of front end of projects. So, in a sense, we are working to deadlines, but not the kind of hard deadlines that may be imposed on a construction site, for instance, where information is critical at a precise time. So we have a certain amount of negotiability in terms of how we deliver projects. But I actually try to, or we as a practice try to avoid that kind of culture. I think it's unhealthy.
Is teaching a rewarding experience for you? Do you teach to also research, or do you find that you learn from students?
Yeah, I mean, our research is really what we do as a practice. So we bring that into the sort of teaching environment and reframe it as a kind of piece of research. But definitely, our long time involvement, over 20 years now, in the Macintosh School, which is also a school I attended, has been this kind of very important connection. Always back to ideas. Always back to the sense of adventure, excitement that I think is really important about what a teaching experience should be, I mean a learning experience. And we certainly feed off that in terms of the students we have. We have great students who are very rewarding in terms of what is produced. So it's a two-way street for us, definitely.
Sense of adventure. Is that the sort of kind of projects that you tend to take on?
I think we do. I think we search out certainly things that are unusual, extraordinary. Mm. We do a lot of competitions, so we choose quite carefully which competitions we do. A lot of our work comes through competitions, work in China. And I think that's because of that process. You have that kind of space to think about or reflect during a competition process rather than having to be given a very hard program and having to work to, let's say, a client's very fixed ideas. So a competition allows, I think, a lot more freedom in terms of interpretation.
What's the relationship of a competition to work or architect as opposed to, I guess, a tender process? Or
yeah, I mean, that's much more the norm these days. It's the tender process, which is entirely financial, seems to me, based on credentials, and is a kind of pre-qualification system, which I think is very efficient for the clients because they narrow down very quickly to, say, three or four architects which can do the job. But I think they miss out on the possibility of exploring wider options by allowing, let's say, ideas to be presented at which a competition allows, a design competition, allows a much more freer interpretation of the possibilities. I think a pre-qualification system tends to be very reductive in terms of the possibilities.
Right. So a competition has that prestige factor as well?
Well, it's a very public process as well. I think I think we've all seen the kind of the results of design competitions where you kind of have a zoo of options and everybody gets involved in the fantasy of the possibility. And I think that kind of culture is very exciting in terms of stimulating debate, the public awareness of architecture, which is fundamental to successful projects that somehow that the public are involved in the process. I think that's important. Mm. And when it goes through a system where it's very much determined by bidding, it tends to lose that kind of engagement with the public.
I haven't seen any reality TV series based on architecture competition out there. There's been a lot of food related competition. not very conducive for the screens, I guess. A lot of people huddling together. Yeah. It's all happening in the mind, right? It's intangible, it's unseen.
Yes, yeah. I think it's different from baking a cake. The process is longer. Yeah. It's more complex. It's not actually very interesting visually,
right.
The process of design. I think a lot of it is it wouldn't make very good TV.
Tonight's Patupan Architect Malaysia Design Lecture Series will take place at the Black Box in Publica. Registration starts at 7:15 p.m. and Charlie's presentation goes on at 7:45. The lecture is open to all and admission is free. You've been listening. Charlie, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.